This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Civil War, The First Omen, Seven, Thelma and Louise, and a bunch of other movies are going to be discussed in this episode of Letterboxd Recap, where we go through the movies we've been watching, as well as rating the Letterboxd top 4 or 5 of you listeners. James, it's been a pretty good week of watching movies. Saw a bunch of new ones this week, including Civil War, which we'll get to in a little bit. And then I watched a couple of classics as well, plus an all-timer from David Fincher.
An all-timer, absolutely. And I only had 4 watches this week. But
was he busy? He's busy.
I've been a little busy. I was rappelling. I was doing some.
Oh yeah,
stuff.
You rappelled down a cliff.
Yeah,
that was pretty cool.
110 feet up in the air is pretty epic.
My first time. So rappelling prevents you from watching a movie.
Well, it's an entire day. Uh-huh. I can't bring a TV while I'm rappelling, Anthony. I can't just like. I know you probably would figure a way if you ever rappelled.
I'd bring that little DVD player we had.
You'd
as
bring
kids.
A portable DVD player and you'd rappel while watching a movie, but. You know, you kind of have to be aware of your entire surroundings and be focused when you're going downhill.
Did you feel like you were in an action scene?
Yeah, kind of.
That's awesome.
Because I went back sitting first, but then my incredible instructor taught me how to go to run down.
You're facing the to run ground, down, yeah.
It's called an Aussie. An Aussie rappel. So you're facing down. You're basically...
Like Tom Cruise on the Burj Khalifa.
Exactly, yeah. Except way less... elegant
and a little lower
you know Burj Khalifa is pretty tall but yeah it's the idea I wasn't swinging like him but I got it's funny because I made that post on Instagram that I did it and so many people sent that gif of Tom Cruise on the Burj Khalifa flying on the rope on the rigging but no, it was a lot of fun so I've been doing stuff like that and again I can't go to Malibu Point Doom and hike and then rappel with a TV to watch a movie or a smartphone, you know,
it would have been
not
cool.
Safe.
You could strap the DVD player to you. Remember we had that DVD player, portable DVD player with a little 6-inch screen.
Yeah, for road trips. It was
great. It was the coolest thing ever.
We were so excited.
We each had our own.
Every road trip. But I mean, I have a smartphone, so I wouldn't need that anymore.
Yeah, but what are you going to do with your DVDs then?
I mean, what do you do with your DVDs?
When
was the last time you popped in a DVD?
I don't know. I can't remember.
When was the last time you used a Blu-ray? Yeah, physical media for us just...
I just bought Lawrence of Arabia, the UHD version. I was
digital?
Just like, fuck it, I'm going to buy it.
Digital or physical?
Digital.
Yeah, the only problem with digital is it could end.
They can take it away whenever.
It could just disappear. They want. It could just disappear.
They could erase it.
Yeah, they could erase movies. You never know, it might happen.
I would like a really great Blu-ray box set of Lawrence of Arabia.
Wow, that's a great Christmas gift idea for Anthony.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, it was a good time. So I got 4 watches in, though.
Nice. I got seven this week.
Typical. That's actually low for you.
One a day is pretty good.
That's pretty low
for
you.
Pretty good. Yeah.
I'm disappointed in
you. I've been busy too, you know? I've been busy doing stuff.
I know.
Yeah.
So don't give me shit then.
I wasn't rappelling, but I was grocery shopping. Every day.
Every day he's going to Trader Joe's.
All right, I'm going to get into my first watch, which is a French film from 1990 from Eric Rohmer. Great French filmmaker. And I watched A Tale of Springtime. Which is part of his quartet elegy. I don't know what you would call the four-film version of a trilogy. A quad elegy. And this is about... So he made 4 of these films. Each one's a different season and a story of characters relating to that season and the themes of it. And it's generally about, you know, younger people. And just like this film, it's about the same... it's about these two women, these two girls who meet at a party and they become very good friends. And one ends up actually crashing at the other's apartment because her boyfriend's out of town and his
his apartment's messy as hell. That's usually where she lives, but she's just sick of living in his mess. And then she has a friend visiting, staying in her place, who she can't stand. So she's like, I got nowhere to sleep. Then she meets this other girl at a party, and the other girl's like, oh, why don't you just stay with me at my apartment? My dad's never home. You can just sleep in his bedroom. So she does, and they become very good friends. However, the dad does eventually show up, and the friend is trying to set up the girl with her dad, who's single and moderately young for having a daughter who's 18. And it starts to create this kind of tension and some conflict within the relationship. It's basically a really great romantic relationship drama, which most of his films in this are like. And it's just really well performed. He's like a, you could call him like a mumblecore director of his time in France, of just authentic people. It feels like you're watching real life. The characters are incredible. And when people are speaking, you're like, oh, this is how people actually talk. So it really immerses you. It makes you feel like you're watching real life happening before your eyes. So I recommend checking out the four films. I just finished it now. So it's a Tale of Springtime, Tale of Summer, Tale of Winter, and Tale of Autumn are the four films. Highly recommend checking them out. They're all really great watches. He's a very minimalist director. Beautiful photography, though. It's just incredible. Long takes, really great interiors and set design. And he likes to shoot with real people in the background. So he'll just go without permits and just shoot like an exterior when there'll be real people there. So it's really cool to see his films. There's nothing like them. Eric Rohmer.
My first watch
four of stars.
The week, my first watch of the week was also a four-star film. I watched a movie for the first time that I have been sort of just meaning to watch for a while. It's always been on the back of my mind whenever I'm like, oh, I wish I watched tonight. Or I
Is
see
it The Adventures of Pluto Nash?
Exactly. No. I watched We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Oh.
Directed by Lynn Ramsey. Came out in 2011, starring Tilda Swinton, John C. Reilly, and Ezra Miller.
Ezra Miller. Ezra Miller guy.
The Boston just came out so bad on that. Ezra Miller kid. And this is an incredible, hardcore thriller, like just freaking dramatic film that will just leave you like empty inside. It is dark, twisted, and it's about this character, Tilda Swinton, who plays a mother who gives birth to a son with her partner, John C. Reilly. But this son is just horrible, horrible to her, and seems to have just been born just to spite her existence in a lot of ways. And the film follows a horrific act. I won't say what it is, what the son does as he's older. But it's a back and forth between time of pre-birth, as the son is a baby, as the son's an infant, a toddler growing up to a teenager, and then they have another daughter, and sort of the relationship between the mother and son, and sort of how this horrific act came to be, to try to somewhat understand or explore his mind. But he's just born at, and then also post act, yeah, as he's in jail and she goes to visit him multiple times.
And also she's dealing with the aftermath of his,
yeah,
act.
The aftermath of what he did, yeah, and now she's an outcast. She's hated. She's, yeah, referred to as the scum of the earth of the people around her in her community, small community, but they all hate her for what her son has done and the act that he committed. And it's very tragic. It's an intense watch. The last 10 minutes will just leave your jaw on the floor. And it's really well acted. I mean, John C. Reilly and Tilda Swinton are super talented. Ezra is terrific in this film. Such a presence on screen at a young age. And Tilda just, you know, I'll watch anything Tilda Swinton does. She puts this movie on her shoulders, of course. But it's just really intense. I've never seen anything quite like it. An exploration of motherhood, of a mother who wants to love her child and give the child everything a baby, a son, a daughter needs in their life to be the best person they can be. But the rejection of every instinct, every motherly instinct, every ounce of love she tries to give the child at every stage, even when it's a baby just crying constantly or and only not crying in the father's arms.
And even a toddler just like hating her.
Demon child. Yeah,
it's
demon
like if
child.
She, it's as if she gave birth to an evil being.
But an evil being that is only out to hurt her, mm-hmm, psychologically. It's just crazy. It's a game in a lot of ways. This entire child's existence growing up from childhood to adolescence, it's sort of like a game of how miserable can I make my mother?
The young version of him is, that kid did a good job too.
It's playing just his evil
playing
glare,
like the 5-year-old version
his
of
apathetic,
him.
I hate you, yeah, stare constantly.
And they do a great job with the wardrobe. If you notice, everything Ezra wears is tight fitting, and like his shirts go over his belts, and His pants are always very tight. They did a great job with the costume design. They purposely did that to make it feel like he doesn't really fit in with anything in the world.
But he's like a baby still. He's a child still. He has diapers until he's 7 or 8. But then you find out like he's just done this whole thing to fuck with his mom.
To torment her.
To torture her psychologically and physically. It's intense. And the last 10 minutes are just horrific and powerful.
Yeah.
But it's a really well-made movie. It starts off very surreal. A lot of great practical surrealism. You know, Lynn Ramsey's great director. She's not messing with like crazy lighting or anything like that. She's taking ordinary things that we see in our lives and making it surreal, like an alarm clock, making that surreal, driving through traffic with stop signs, making that look surreal. So really great artistic vision in this film too.
She's fantastic. It's her best film, and it's an incredible film about violence and evil. And man, if you haven't seen it, check it out. It is a tough watch though. It's very intense. Great watch though, by
Thanks.
The way. Great choice. I'm glad you finally saw it. What'd you rate it?
4.
Nice. All right, next up, I watched a Terrence Malick film that I hadn't seen in a while, The New World, which I gave 4.5 stars, and I wrote, Terrence Malick, you're one of a kind. This is basically a loose retelling of the Pocahontas story and the early pilgrims who first landed in the New England area and interacted with the native population there, and actually tells facets of the Pocahontas story that were never told in the other iterations, which is really interesting. Most fascinating is she actually did travel to England to meet the king and queen, and she was dressed up in like very formal British attire with a hat, top hat, and this dress and everything. So that's something I never knew about Pocahontas until seeing this film. Obviously, there's a lot of historical inaccuracies and dramatization, but they did do a ton of research, and Terrence Malick actually wrote this in the late 70s, and he wanted to make it after Days of Heaven, but he could never get funding for it. So funding didn't come through with a production company interested in the project until the early 2000s, and then he was able to finally get a green light, cast Colin Farrell, cast Christopher Plummer, Christian Bale, incredible cast. Ben Mendelsohn's in this as well, just a remarkable cast, as well as a very strong breakout performance from the actress who plays Pocahontas, who is, I'm sorry, Karanka Kilcher. She's fantastic. She's made a pretty successful career since this film debut of hers, and she was only a teenager when she was cast. Wes Studi is in this. He's like a Hollywood icon for playing Native American characters, and then David Thewlis is great in this as well. It's an interesting story. It's an interesting approach to this thing that we know about. And I just love the idea of, you know, this is the world we are on now, but it was so different just a few hundred years ago. And there were so few people there until the Europeans arrived. But the way Terrence Malick approaches the filmmaking with his first collaboration with Emmanuel Lubezki is fantastic. And just the long takes, the handheld, the Steadicam, it really inserts you into the world and makes it feel like you're in the reality of like, holy shit, this is like a historical event film, but like the camera work makes you feel very much like you're there with them. Obviously, Lubezki liking to get very close to the characters and following them around, because we've seen so many epics and not historical epics, and they always have the same kind of stories, very much same kind of scenes and plots, and every scene has a importance, and there's dialogue, and it's all plot heavy. But with Malick, he just likes to follow people walking around, and what would be a monologue that is well shot and perfectly blocked by another filmmaker, Terrence Malick is like, let's just shoot it wide, Steadicam, and have the actual person delivering the monologue like in a crowd far in the distance, so that it makes you feel like you're a spectator, a part of the group. So his approach to filmmaking is really second to none in what he likes to do. And it's really just incredible how he directs his scenes and really makes you feel like they are coming to life. Colin Farrell is very good, and Christian Bale is very good. Christopher Plummer is great. So all around, it's just a fabulous production with some of the best camera work of its day.
Very cool. I haven't seen that since you showed me it maybe 5, 6 years ago. It's a terrific film. It really is. I just saw a cool bit of news. You want to hear it?
Let's hear it.
Edgar Wright is making a new adaptation of The Running Man.
No way!
This is a Stephen King book, but obviously Arnold Schwarzenegger starred in a film of it in the 1987.
That's awesome.
And Edgar Wright's doing it, and Glenn Powell has been cast in the lead role.
Oh, finally, a new Edgar Wright movie.
I know, right? I'm very excited.
Sounds like he's going back to what he likes best.
Yeah, just cool action.
Fun action.
Comedy action. Let's do it. And
that's a great pair.
Yeah, I just saw because CinemaCon's going on right now, and I was just glancing at my phone on Twitter, on movie Twitter, to see what's going on while you were doing that. Great synopsis and plot breakdown. And that's a cool bit of information.
So you weren't listening to me?
No, I wasn't.
No. Hey, at least you're honest. I start talking and James browses the internet.
No, I was looking at movie stuff. It's relevant.
James is just scrolling through Twitter. Yeah, whatever. Just keep whatever. Fucking New World, whatever. Fucking. Here we go with another random movie no one's heard of, Anthony.
I've seen it. I like it.
First a French film and then the New World. Oh, great. Our audience is going
to
love this.
I'm trying to do two jobs. I'm trying to be co-host, as well as sort of like a topic kind of guy right now.
A topic guy. You're a topic guy.
Yeah, I'm the trendsetter. I have to, keep the ball rolling.
Reading out a news headline is not being a trendsetter.
It's not that I wasn't listening to you. It's that I knew everything you were going to say, and I'm like, Anthony's got this, man. He's going to do a great job explaining this movie to the listeners.
Oh, so it's trust. It's a positive thing.
Exactly.
You trust me.
I trust you completely to break down the film New World easy. The New World. I was waiting for that.
You got it, man.
Anyways.
Yeah,
Running Man. The Running Man. It should be cool. Who do we have for our five fans in their four favorites? Which I will 100% listen to this, Anthony.
Now I have your attention. All right, first up in our Letterboxd top four is Venery Cartola.
Venery!
I hope I said that right, pal.
He probably didn't.
I'll be back is his bio.
It's great.
And also it's the dude driving his car is his profile photo. It's fantastic. All right, first up we got Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King.
That's what I'm talking about.
By the way, Venery just did a Lord of the Rings marathon, so... Five star. Love it. Well, first he did There Will Be Blood, 5-star. Then Lord of the Rings, 5-star.
What a week.
That's a hell of a week. Then we got Mississippi Burning,
which is
a really great movie starring Gene Hackman. Willem Dafoe has a supporting role as well. It's a great courtroom drama. Apocalypse Now.
Film Boy.
And then Goodfellas.
That's what I'm talking about
there. This is a Film Boy
That's
top
what
four.
I'm talking about.
Venery, you're a Film Boy. Oh, man, I love it.
What a great name, too.
I haven't seen Mississippi Burning in a minute. That's a good one. All right, next up we have Black Canvas Art 95, all the way in Ireland. His bio is, see you at the movies, Tom Cruise 2022.
See you at the movies!
See you at the movies! Anyways, I gotta get this shot. Q's giving me the signal. All right, first up we got Drive.
Hell yeah.
Film Boy. That sounded awful.
That's pretty good.
I was like, what are you doing at first? And if you thought he was a film boy now, wait until you hear the next one. Nightcrawler.
That's what I'm talking about. I'm seeing a trend.
Wind River.
Cool.
Fallout.
What a great list of movies right there.
Film Boy.
It's a very... I don't think we've had... Wind River yet, and I feel like we haven't had that many drives.
We have not had that many drives.
If we were doing Letterboxd Recap 6-7 years ago, we'd get drives like crazy.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That
Especially
was,
when it came out.
Yeah. The 2010s.
That would have been in my top four.
Yeah. Saw that movie, I think, 7 times in a 3-year period.
I saw it 4 times in theaters.
Yeah, that movie really...
I was just really blown away by it.
All the film boys out there went and saw Drive consistently every year.
We just didn't know we were film boys then.
Yeah,
now
we were so drawn
now
to
Now we
Drive.
Know what we are.
We all thought we were Driver. We all thought we were Ryan Gosling and Drive.
I think we all just wanted to be him. We all just were like, that's what I would want to do.
That's basically, is that me?
Everything about that.
We all looked at that movie, we were like, I think that's me on screen.
We all
right
bought
now.
Scorpion jackets.
We all beat people with hammers.
I just carried a hammer around with me everywhere.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Weird.
The soundtrack is great. I listen to it all the time.
All right, next up, we got Robert John Leet. What's up, Robert?
Hey, Robert.
All right, we got, got some horror here. Halloween.
Nice.
The Shining.
Here we go.
Insidious.
Oh, I like that.
And then White Zombie, which I've never seen.
What is White Zombie?
Look it up. I don't know. But he gave it 4 stars. It must be cool. White Zombie. And then recently, he's watched Inception, Godzilla, White Zombie, and
1932.
Avengers.
Wow. I was going to say, it sounds like a silent film.
It's got a cool poster. Robert, you just introduced us to a new movie. It's got a great poster. I'm curious.
I feel like I've heard of this and seen stills of it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. But yeah, we gotta check it out. I think it's one of the OG zombie movies.
Oh, interesting. Well, thank you for sharing that, Robert. Looks like we got a film boy over here.
Film boy. So, the plot is... Murder Legendre is the menacingly named zombie master of Haiti, Charles Beaumont, goes to him when he needs help for a twisted plan. Spurned in marriage by Madeline Short, Beaumont has decided on a simple solution. Kill Short and bring her back as a zombie. Then he can be with her forever. The only problem comes when Legendre keeps the fetching girl for himself and her new husband comes to Madeline's rescue.
Ah, fun. Sounds cool. Sounds very Warm Bodies-esque.
Yeah. Seems very vampiric as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, moving on to Cammy. Hey, Cammy.
Cammy.
Her bio is... Oh, sorry, Cammy.
I
said like a Bostonian.
He always gets it wrong.
I like what I like. That's her bio. All right, first up, we got Catch Me If You Can.
That's what I'm talking about right there.
It's a banger. Prisoner of Azkaban.
That's what I'm talking about.
Clue.
Mm-hmm.
Fun pick. And then Ocean's 11. I have a feeling you like this top four.
Kami, did we just become best friends? I freaking love Oceans. I love Oceans. I have an Ocean's 11 poster.
It's a perfect movie.
It really is. It's really absolutely terrific.
Perfect heist.
That's a terrific list.
And then recently, Kami has watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, mm-hmm. Dazed and Confused, mm-hmm. Senna, and Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. Speaking of Edgar
Great
Wright.
Taste. You know what Kami is?
Film girl! Film girl.
Did you say film boy?
Yeah.
You can't speak.
Just call them all film boys.
Film girl. No, Anthony.
Film girl.
Get it right.
All right, we got one more. And this is definitely a film boy if I have to say so myself. We got Matt Holland.
That's what I'm talking about.
Inception.
Mm-hmm. Another one.
Apocalypse Now.
Another one.
Film boy. Blade Runner 2049.
Let's go.
And then The Father.
Oh, what a great pick.
With Anthony Hopkins.
What a great pick.
One of the most underrated films of the last several years.
I'm afraid to revisit that movie because it made me so emotional.
It's a 10 out of 10, I think. I think that movie's fantastic.
Yeah, I would say it's a 10 out of 10, too.
Well, some people were complaining that he won the Oscar. I was like, have you seen the movie?
It's incredible.
Have you seen it?
Because the year Chadwick died, people were expecting Chadwick to win.
Yeah, but they didn't even see Chadwick's movie.
True.
No
one saw it. Yeah.
No one saw that movie. It's silly. People.
Ma Rainey.
Yeah, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. And it's funny, people were complaining that, like, Anthony Hopkins won, but, like, you didn't see either movie. How can you
Anthony
have an opinion?
Anthony Hopkins is so good in The Father. It's one of the best performances of the last 10 years.
And of his career, it could be his best.
Yeah, and this is Anthony Hopkins.
And, yes, he's old, and, yes, he's been doing it for a long time, but still, like, you never seen him do anything like this before. It was incredible.
I've never seen a performance like that before.
What a remarkable feat of acting, I gotta say. All right, Matt recently...
I want my mommy.
Aww.
Oh my God, I'm tearing up already.
Matt recently watched Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the animated film,
mm-hmm.
Lego Movie Part 2,
mm-hmm.
Ahsoka, and Kelsey, the documentary.
Sounds like
series.
A film boy.
Film boy! Thank you to everybody who sent in their Letterboxd Top 4. If you'd like to have your Top 4 read online, on the podcast, I mean, all you gotta do is screenshot it and DM it to us on the gram. Then that will get you into the list. We're catching up. We're almost at the end of 2023 with the list. We're getting there, man. Getting there one day at a time. All right, let's take it away with the rest of our Letterboxd watches.
Would you like to go first since you have a few more? Or is your next watch the combined watch?
It does not.
Okay.
It does not. I watched Lawrence of Arabia, which I gave 5 stars, obviously. And
obviously.
I wrote, cinema's greatest treasure that is written. This is one of my favorite films in... It's probably the greatest film ever made. It's up there from director David Lean. And it's actually, it's got to be probably the most impressive debut acting performance in a film from Peter O'Toole. It was his first on-screen acting role.
It was his first role?
As a film, yeah.
What?
Yeah. It was, yeah.
He's acting like with the presence of a 20-year veteran in cinema.
Well, he was a stage actor.
Yeah, but I'm talking about cinema.
Oh, yeah. He's unbelievable. It's because it says introducing Peter O'Toole.
Yeah, that's right.
It's unbelievable. It's an incredible film. There's really nothing like it. It's 3.5 hours, so it's a long watch, but it's worth it. The filmmaking in this film is second to none. There's really nothing like it still to this day. Like, the fact that they pulled this off with the bulky, heavy, limited equipment that they had at the time of 1962, it's just I can't believe it. I can't fathom it. David Lean was the king of the epic. He made Dr. Zhivago as well, Bridge on the River Kwai. This, and he also made a couple other great, huge films like Ryan's Daughter. The Journey to India, just incredible films that were always shot on such a massive scale. And he does a great job with this film. There's no one's still to this day hasn't been able to really do it. Showing the landscapes, especially of the Wadi Rum in Jordan and all over the deserts, and staging these huge sequences with the complications of animals and camels and horses and huge props and set pieces and giant amounts of extras, but also shooting them from literally miles away with huge telephoto lenses so that you can really see in scale the size of the mountains, the size of the giant rock formations, and the size of the expansive deserts with the cast and crew just being – the cast being little specks on the screen, just tiny specks. Like, they shot this from such far, vast distances away from the actual scenes. It's just – so striking to behold, and Peter O'Toole's performance is unbelievable. It's a fascinating story. T. Lawrence really did these things, lived this life, and it's also an interesting part of history that especially Americans don't know about. I'm sure Brits learn more about it, about the Arab-Turk War that Britain was involved in, because they were part of it for quite a while, and T. E. Lawrence was just a figure who came out of nowhere. He was nothing. He was just a lowly soldier, and then he did extraordinary things, and he became an instrumental part of the entire campaign. But the sequences are just breathtaking to behold, and some of the most stunning filmmaking still, even in the modern era. It's hard for films to even compete with the landmark production that is Lawrence of Arabia. And it's just fantastic performances all around, production, costuming. It's just this movie floors me every time I see it. Plus, one of the best themes ever written for film, with the Lawrence of Arabia theme from Bernard Herrmann, and one of his greatest scores ever. And what I like about this movie is, even if you watch it on streamer, it starts with a 5-minute overture of a black screen with just the themes playing, which is really cool and really sets you into the scene. And then it has a title credit sequence, which is great. So it just feels like old Hollywood that you never see anymore.
Well said. Really well said.
Were you browsing Twitter while I said that?
I was listening to you the whole time.
Oh, thank you so much.
My hands have been clasped.
you were thrilled. You were at the edge of your seat.
Enthralled. All right. Was your next watch our combined watch?
No.
Get to your next watch, and then we'll do our... And then your combined watch is after that?
Yes.
All right, cool.
The First Omen, which I watched a week and a half ago, but I didn't log it. So then I logged it this week because I forgot to, because it was an embargo when I did watch it. So The First Omen, I gave 3.5 stars. It's pretty good. I wrote, evil nuns are so hot right now. Literally at the top, both in the top 10 of the box office the same weekend. It's so weird. They're
weeks apart, these movies came out. Immaculate and The Omen. The First Omen.
So The First Omen, it's visually...
Like, I'm never going to look at nuns the same again.
I don't get what was
next so... Next time I see a nun, I'll be like, you're conspiring something.
Hollywood was like, fucking evil nuns, let's go. this spring.
So hot. Nuns. Evil.
I wrote, visually impressive and well acted, The First Omen is a solid entry in the Omen IP and is worth a watch for fans of the original. It's good. It's well directed. It's visually striking. Gorgeous cinematography. Again, it's shot in Italy.
Yeah, I was going to say, is the location Italy? Yeah, are you fucking kidding me?
It's all
me?
In Italy.
I'm sorry. I fucking love Italy, but again, every movie's being shot in Italy right now.
It's getting redundant. It's getting redundant.
They must have a great tax credit. They must.
I think it's tax credit because after COVID, they're like, we need tourism back. So they just probably were like, everyone shoot here, please.
We need some a boost to the economy. Yeah. But so many movies are filming in Italy. I mean, it's gorgeous, obviously.
Yeah.
But there are other gorgeous places you can shoot. They just must have a great credit for films.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, both Immaculate and the Omen, the Catholic Church is a main instrumental part of what they wrote, so it makes sense to shoot it in Italy. In this one, you know, you get a sense that it's near the Vatican, not in the Vatican, but like the Vatican's involved, although they don't explicitly say it, but you get the sense for that. So the first Omen, it's good. It was interesting, and like I said, really well crafted, well acted, especially with the lead actress. She did a phenomenal job. I'm a huge fan of the original. This one, obviously, is a direct prequel. It's not a spinoff. It's literally, it sets up the original film starring Gregory Peck, which is a phenomenal movie. Ultimately, it kind of left a bit of a bad taste in my mouth because it really rewrote a little too much and ended with this, I don't want to spoil it, but it ended with the setup for the original film. And I was like, I don't know about that. It does have really good moments. It has some good imagery and some good ideas and themes that it's illustrating, especially with womanhood and the idea of the female in the Catholic Church. It has some cool imagery, but also the first Omen didn't have anything to do with the church being involved, but in this film, it basically is like the church is at behind everything, which I found to be a little odd. And then on top of that, there were just a little too many plot holes, characters getting out of situations and then things happening just like when they had to happen for plot's sake. And just a little bit too much of that where the writing just didn't quite meet up with the visual spectacle that you were seeing, because it is really well made, very visually impressive. And then on top of that, for any fans of Rosemary's Baby, it basically took the Omen and made it Rosemary's Baby, which I didn't really love.
That's kind of... Yeah, unfortunate.
I mean, you get a sense for that in the trailer, but they really do pull a lot from that film, which I think should not be touched in the horror genre. Like, just leave Rosemary's Baby alone. And it just pulled a little too much from that, where it didn't even feel like the Omen anymore. You know what I mean? It felt like it was a Rosemary's Baby adaptation as opposed to an Omen adaptation sometimes.
I guess they're probably thinking... Obviously, if you've never seen The Omen, spoiler alert right now, it's a pretty old film, 1976-ish. The boy in the film is the Antichrist.
Yeah, Damien.
So,
yeah, everyone knows that.
No, I just want to... Yeah. Not everyone's seen The Omen, so I just want to give a spoiler warning. Not everyone's seen it, bro. It's not The Godfather.
No, but everyone knows Damien is the Antichrist.
Not everyone has seen The Omen.
All right, fine.
You got to stop acting like everyone has seen everything, Anthony.
No, I didn't say everyone's seen it. I'm just thinking everybody knows that. Like, oh, it's about the Antichrist.
Yeah, but I didn't say the boy's name. I just said the boy. Mm-hmm. Anyways, let me just get to it. So this boy is the Antichrist. Damien. So I guess they're probably like, let's use Rosemary's Baby as the blueprint for how the Antichrist is born. I guess that's how it would happen in a lot of ways. You know, you'd have some crazy cult giving birth, doing rituals, and giving birth to the Antichrist through a woman. I get it, but it does sound disappointing because I haven't seen it, and I love Rosemary's Baby. It's one of my all-time favorite movies.
Yeah.
And it's disappointing that we have two movies this year that are very much Rosemary's Baby, I wouldn't say ripoffs, influenced heavily by Rosemary's Baby.
Ultimately, the issue was the story would have been a lot better if it wasn't set in the church, because... Like I said, and you get in the trailer, like the church is the ones doing everything, and that's not what really made sense. Knowing what the Omen is, where the Omen is like a private, secret cult of a group of people doing it, mm-hmm. and they birthed Damien, but in this film it's like the church birthed Damien, and I was like, what? That big change. It would have worked better if it was not set in the Catholic Church, gotcha. In my opinion. Like if it was still, you could have still had a nun being the victim, but like. It would have worked better if it was like this unknown secret society doing it all. I think it would have been it would have been better for the film overall. But there, I think that people were like really into the imagery of evil nuns this year.
Evil nuns are hot.
I think it's like the imagery was like what they were trying to portray. Like, oh, evil church, evil nuns, murdering nuns. So like that's what was more powerful to them when they were making the movie.
All right, let's get into the next film on both of our lists.
Yes.
Is the biggest film that A24 has ever produced, their largest budget yet, with Alex Garland's Civil War. It's dropping and hitting theaters this weekend. We got to see it early access. Thanks so much to IMAX for the invite. We had a great time attending this at the beautiful TCL Chinese theater in Hollywood, which if you're ever in LA, you got to see a movie in this theater because it is gorgeous in the screen. It may be the biggest screen you'll ever see a movie on unless you live in New York where there's an 80-foot IMAX screen. And then I think, was it Seattle or Washington has 90-foot? Or no, it's Canada. Canada has a 90-foot IMAX screen. But this theater is gorgeous, the interiors. Now, the budget on Civil War, excuse me, I'm about to sneeze. Excuse me. The allergies have been rampant this past 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'm dying.
Anthony can attest to the amount of times I sneeze per day. The production budget is listed as $50 million on Civil War. And then on top of that with a marketing budget. So it probably costs about $100 million to make and market this film-ish, $75 to $100 million. And it has to, you know, hit a good amount of money because A24 has never invested this much. So they're hoping to have a hit on their hands. Now, this takes place in around our time right now. And a civil war has broken out in the United States. And we will not spoil anything in this short Letterboxd review. It's a near future kind of film. And it follows a group of war journalists, specifically journals for writing journalists, as well as photojournalists who attempt to survive the civil war. While attempting to reach Washington, D.C., where the goal of the main journalists in the film is to photograph the president of the United States, who has not been photographed in 18 months and is on his third term now, and also interview him while in the middle of a civil war. So they're traveling from Pennsylvania to Washington, D.C., and following the perspective of the journalists, we are entered into different combat scenarios, sequences, traveling through cities, seeing some horrific things. And I thought this movie was really good. I don't think it's anywhere near Alex Garland's best work. I think Ex Machina or Ex Machina, depending on if you live in the UK, I think that's what they call it out there, Ex Machina, is a stellar film. It's an all-time science fiction film for me. It's one of my favorite movies this century. I mean, he's a great writer as well, 28 Days Later. He's a great filmmaker. Did not love Men. And this movie I thought was pretty good. You know, it's not as divisive as you think it would be. From the trailer, it seems like it could go one way, either alienating one part of the country, half the country, and obviously promoting the other half. It's not like that at all. So that was actually a pleasantly nice surprise for me. There were subtle hints here and there, but overall, it doesn't take a biased perspective politically for the United States, really. It's more of just speaking to the average citizen. It's a very much an anti-war film at its core. And the action sequences are solid. Some of the tactical stuff I thought didn't make a ton of sense to me. But, you know, I think that there's obviously hyperbolic things going on there. People are saying it's the best combat ever put on screen before. I'm like, have you not seen Saving Private Ryan?
Oh, my God. Why does everything have to be the best ever?
It's the best ever.
You not seen the Normandy scene?
But there's some really great stuff in this movie when it comes to combat. There's incredible visuals. It looks terrific. The sound design in this film is sensational. Sounds so goddamn good, especially in a big theater.
Yeah.
I love the combat, the gunfire, the explosions, the warfare. It really made you feel like you were in there. Being in the perspective of the journalist, I think, works for the majority of the film. Sometimes it doesn't work too well when we're just constantly following the journos. But overall, I think it's a solid movie. It's a bold film. And like I said, it's not going to be a divisive film for political parties. You know, I don't think that half the country going to be like, oh my God, this movie hates me, I'm pissed off. I don't think it's going to be like that at all.
And the reason for that is because, and I gave this 3.5 stars out of 5, 7 out of 10. Would you rate it?
I gave it a 3 out of 5, so, 6 out of 10.
So it's not as polarizing as I thought it would be, and that's because ultimately for me, the film had some strengths in terms of the visuals and then the production, and it really did come alive in the third act. In a good way, and I was really into the third act, and I mean, I liked the ending. It was a pretty good ending, but what surprised me was how hollow the movie was, and how nothing had context. And the reason why it's not polarizing is because it didn't really have anything to say. It kind of was just a film about observing, and it really was about, you know, photojournalism. I found it to be more of a film about the questioning the morals of being a war journalist than anything. That was the biggest takeaway for me for the film.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Of like war journalism.
I'm trying to show people what's happening, but I'm also a part of it in
exactly,
a way.
Exactly, yeah. So those were like the most significant parts of the film I saw, because everything about the Civil War was just kind of numb and not really, he wasn't really making any points at all. And there was no clarity. There was no context. I actually missed the part where the president was on a third term. I must have missed that part.
Oh, it's in there, yeah.
It's in there. It must have just been a quick line of dialogue. That I
think the trailer is just a little misleading to what this film is.
Yeah.
Because that line is actually in the trailer as well, but it's not said. I don't want to spoil the film, but I think people will be surprised by the amount of screen time Nick Offerman has in this film as the president of the United States. I was a little surprised by that. And again, some of the tactical stuff, we saw it with an ex-military friend.
Yeah.
And he had some things to say about the tactical stuff. But some of the combat was actually really terrific. You know, some of the sequences where, you know, they're entering Washington, D.C., it's really great. I thought it was really effective use of CGI in this film as well. It's really striking to see a war in modern day America on our soil like that.
Yeah, it was cool. It was interesting imagery.
Because that's something we've never really seen before on that scale. Obviously, we've seen Civil War films, World War II films, obviously in other countries. But to see like a massive war of this scale on American soil was really interesting to see visually in contemporary times.
I just think that it narratively was just missing any kind of subtext or direction. And it was basically an Odyssey film. Like the first thing I thought of after walking out there was Homer's Odyssey and a journey and encountering different escapades along your way to your eventual goal. And the goal is to make it to the White House. So he made an Odyssey film, and the characters interact and encounter these situations along the way. It's just that I just think that narratively it was lacking in a voice. And I didn't really love any of the characters. The performances were great. Kaylee Spaney is a newcomer, and she's really fantastic. And Kirsten Dunst did a good job. And
Jesse Plemons. Scene stealer, like usual.
If Jesse Plemons didn't show up, it would have been a much lesser movie.
Yeah, I think so, too. That's how strong his character is.
His scene and his moment was so impactful.
Let's not spoil anything.
Sorry. And ultimately, it was just a little... The script just relied a little too heavily on plot armor for me. And just some getting out of things, and you're tying up loose ends, and things happening inexplicably. Just it was ultimately the story is what underwhelmed me.
But it's bold. It's bold to make a Civil War film in America, contemporary times. It looked great for a $50 million budget, and I think it's definitely worth a watch. And we love A24. It's always great to support them. Yeah, I think I just looked it up. I thought it was higher, but
I thought it was 90.
I just Googled and it said Civil War budget. Damn, is $50 million. Yeah, 50 mil.
Looked great.
Yeah, it looked terrific for 50 mil. Like, excellent use of CGI.
Well, he's great. He's smart with the CGI, and I think he learned this with Ex Machina. So these huge, expansive set pieces with all these artillery and machines and helicopters and tanks, he does them with just very few number of shots. So that way you can really afford the CGI and not overwhelm your budget. Instead, because rather than doing 16 different shots of like a helicopter and tanks and stuff, he does like a couple of big wides.
I think it reminded me a lot of Arrival and the filmmaking there, because obviously that base at the bottom of the ship next to the ship, next to the massive vessel, they built some of that base camp, and then a lot of the extra structures and the troops on the ground from those wide shots, those helicopter shots, are CGI, as well as pretty much all the helicopters in Arrival are CGI.
Yeah.
Except for maybe one or two when they're up close to the camera. Same thing with this film. Much of the weaponry, artillery, and helicopters in this film are CGI.
I thought of Arrival. Yeah, you're right. It did feel like Arrival.
But then building some of the structures on the ground so that we have a base to work with.
And to interact with the actors.
A couple of real helicopters. Yeah. Some great practical combat in city streets in Washington, D.C. was just epic. But some of the tactical stuff just didn't make a ton of sense to me. But I think people understand what I mean when they see it.
Yeah. Ultimately, it was an interesting movie. It was not what I was expecting, and I just left a little underwhelmed, and I was hoping for something more, for the film to have something more to say, and it didn't really.
Yeah, the context just wasn't there completely. I don't want to spoil what we mean by lack of context, but it felt like it felt like a sequel to a movie that was already made. It felt like a sequel to a Civil War movie where a Civil War broke out.
Sure.
And so everything's should be known by the audience, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then you watch this film and you would get it because you saw the first film, but there is no first film.
Yeah.
but definitely worth the watch. I'm sure a lot of you will enjoy the hell out of this film. A24, obviously, one of the best studios making films out there in a very bold project from Alex Garland. And let's move on to how many watches do you have left, Anthony?
I got two watches left.
I have two as well. Who wants to go first? I'll go first. My first watch was Seven, nice. Which is probably my 17th time watching this movie. And we've talked about this film in the past. We did an episode on it.
Great,
like,
episode.
2 years ago. It was an excellent episode.
Excellent.
Excellent skiing. And I love this film, and I rewatched it because we're doing an episode on John Doe, specifically the killer in this film.
Evil Explorer.
Coming out in like a week and a half, which I can't wait to talk about because it's such a fascinating character in such a marquee film in the great David Fincher's career. His second film, he makes Seven, which is a masterpiece, incredible investigation film, great mystery. It's a serial killer film, and you don't really see much killing in this movie, but it's still disturbing. When you think about this film, you think about, oh my God, it's horrific, it's gory, it's terrible. There's not that much in there.
You want to hear something crazy?
Yes.
So in Seven, you only see one murder take place, mm-hmm. and it's not John Doe. It's Mills commits the murder.
Yeah.
So John Doe, we don't even see him kill anyone.
Yeah, that's what's
crazy.
The
only murder we see is committed by someone who's not the serial killer.
That's what's crazy about this film. It's so genius, this script. It's not based on anything. It's a brilliant, brilliant original screenplay. And obviously the guy who wrote this movie, he wrote The Killer, right?
Yes.
His name is...
So Kevin Walker.
Andrew Kevin Walker. Great screenwriter. Love Seven. I mean, we've done episodes on this and we've talked about it in the past and we'll be talking about it in a week and a half. I don't have to say too much more else on it. I know everyone listening to this show probably loves this film as well. And
I found some great Letterboxd reviews if you want to
hear. Oh yeah, let's hear it.
Kevin Spacey gives Brad Pitt head. No clickbait.
Oh my God. What's in the box?
Seven's ending scene is by far my favorite unboxing video.
I saw a great video meme of unboxing videos today where there's this thing where people, their loved ones, they'll die, they'll pass away, and then they'll be in a casket, but then they'll dump the casket in the ocean. And so there's a video of people dumping a casket in the ocean, and then it cuts to a POV of someone doing a shark filter on a shark's face. They're like, welcome to my new unboxing video. Let's open up this one and see what we have inside.
I love that. I watched Seven as well. I watched it last night. I gave it 5 stars. And I wrote, Fincher's best.
That's it.
I got some great comments. Lopez 699 wrote, yes. Ryan L., scalding hot take. Eb, so real. Seven was the first Fincher movie I saw, and it's still my favorite. The Extra Credits podcast, me staring at this view like Jesse Eisenberg as Mark Zuckerberg. I love Seven. It's his best work, I think, especially I've seen it many. It might be my most watched Fincher film, I'd say. Definitely more than Fight Club, more than Social Network.
It's kind of messed up, Anthony.
I know. It's something wrong with me. It's just so well directed. Everything. It's perfect. Everything from the camera work to the lighting to the acting. The script is fantastic. And I like watching movies that I love many times because you see things on a new level. And I saw something on this rewatch that I never noticed before. It's because I've seen it. I've been exposed to the film so many times that I finally caught this basically huge glaring editing error. Not error, but this editing issue they ran into in the finale. And I'd never noticed it before. And it must have been a nightmare to edit the finale because they shot it in that location, that desert location, obviously. But they clearly shot it at all times of day because the lighting doesn't match. And so, but the thing is, Fincher and any good filmmaker knows that the lighting doesn't have to match from actor to actor. It's really, if the moment's working, then the audience will not notice the change in light. So another great example is The Tree of Life, Emmanuel Lubezki. He came up with this concept that, so if you watch movies that he shoots, like The Tree of Life, like The Revenant, what have you, he will shoot the dialogue scenes with the sun behind every actor. It doesn't make sense for a scene. If you have a reverse shot, two actors speaking, someone should be facing the sun and someone should have the sun behind them. And so when you do the reverse shot, that person should have sun on their face. But he knows the audience will not notice that. As long as it looks great and they're immersed in the moment. So if you watch The Tree of Life, every scene, every shot of an actor, the sun's behind them, which doesn't make logistic sense blocking-wise in reality. but he knows you can get away with it. And then with seven, the lighting in the finale between the trio, it doesn't always match. Sometimes the light's on the right side of John Doe's face, sometimes it's on the left side of his face. I never fucking noticed that until this watch. And I was like, holy shit, it's so inconsistent, but they edit it in a very patient way. And the moment is so powerful that your brain doesn't even register the change in the direction of the light. Because they shot one part, because they shot Kevin Spacey in the morning, and then they shot him in the evening. And so you have the sunlight on the right, the morning light on the right side, and then the dusk light on his left side. But it doesn't matter. And it's literally a shot and edit within 30 seconds, and it should be the same light, but it's not. But I didn't even notice that on any other watches until now. And I was like, oh my God, I'm pointing out all these things. And it's like, it doesn't matter. So even the greatest films of all time, there's inconsistencies. But if the moment's powerful enough, it doesn't matter. And the audience will be along for the ride.
Yeah, every movie has continuity issues.
Yeah. But I was like, oh my God, I never noticed this. This is crazy.
There's a truck in Braveheart.
Yeah.
They're like, fuck it. No one's going to notice. And then the internet.
But I know Fincher and the editor were fucking going crazy. It must have been a nightmare to edit that sequence together. I know they were like, fuck, we got to edit around this. And then there's also another thing that they edited around I never noticed before, but it was just because I've seen this movie so many times, I noticed these little things. It's a great rewatch, though.
All right, my final film of the week was a horror film, a zombie film. I watched Quarantine, which is a remake of the Spanish found footage film called Wreck. And I've seen parts of this, but I never finished it before. But I watched it with some people last night, and it was so fun. It's an excellent horror film. It's found footage. It starts off with this woman, a journalist. It's Jennifer Carpenter, who's Deb from Dexter.
Deb, that's her name.
She's a news reporter, and her camera guy, they're doing a story on a local firehouse and the firefighters inside, sort of like the day in the life, a night in the life of firefighters. And it starts off really well. The dialogue is delivered so well. It feels like they sort of have footnotes of what they want to say, and they're just letting the actors improvise. But then it gets a little more scripted later on. And it's great. It starts off light. It's fun. It's hysterical. It's a little raunchy until they get a call finally, and they all go on this call in this building. This woman, this deranged woman, is very sick, and she's covered in blood. And it turns out this is a zombie outbreak that's happened inside this apartment complex, this apartment building. And eventually, the police, even though there's cops inside with them, there's firefighters inside with the news reporters as well, the entire building gets quarantined and they don't know why. And eventually throughout the story, we discover that there's an outbreak, a viral outbreak of rabies, some sort of rabies infection that causes people to go insane and to kill each other and to eat each other. And it's so scary. It's so good. I had a blast. It's engaging. It's short. It's like 80, 85 minutes. And the energy is excellent. It's very constant flow of just keeping you engaged the whole time. Great editing, some awesome wonders. There's a couple of shots that are felt like 10 minutes long of going up different flights of stairs, several characters, bodies falling down, like multiple stories, all in these wonders. It's terrific filmmaking. Budget's pretty low. It's about $10, $12 million. And then it gets really great. And it's an excellent conclusion to the third act. And I really enjoyed it. It's sort of like a haunted house in the end, when you're running around with just like the camera and the flashlight, and there's zombies coming out from all over the place, and everyone's getting infected, and the great dynamics of what happens to humans in these claustrophobic, high-tense situations, sort of a hierarchy forms, power forms, a person with the most powerful weapon has control, as well as mystery of what's going on, and then trying to escape, being quarantined, the helicopters and police outside the building, the CDC comes in. It's crazy. It's a really well-made movie on a low budget. I really enjoyed the hell out of it. I gave it 4 stars.
Yeah, it's a fun movie. It's not well-liked, though, with
really
very low ratings, 6 on IMDb.
That's pretty low.
I like that movie a lot. It's really good, really well done. For found footage, it's really up there. Very successful.
It's a 2.5 on Letterboxd?
Yeah,
what?
It's not liked at all.
This movie's sick.
Yeah. I'm not sure if found footage plays very well anymore.
I guess
audiences.
Not, because
I think it's a really good movie. Well, it did really well at the box office, $41 million. So it was a profitable film.
I guess people sometimes also, they don't like remakes, I guess.
Yeah, maybe that, but also maybe not everyone's a fan of found footage.
But when it comes to, yeah, true. And when it comes to remakes, this is really good. Yeah. It's a really good remake. I enjoyed the hell out of it.
It's an electric horror film.
I want to watch the original now, the Spanish version.
Yeah, I bet it's great. I've never seen the Spanish one. I've just seen the quarantine. All right, moving on to my final watch. I ended the week with a Ridley Scott film. And I put this on because I saw it at the gym. And I was like, I'm going to watch it. And it's Thelma and Louise.
Nice.
Which is one of the best, just one of the coolest, best road action movies ever. And so I put it on because I was at the gym the other day and it was on one of the channels on TV. And the directing is so strong and the camera work and the editing and the cinematography. It's so good that I was absolutely enthralled. And I've seen this movie before a few times, but I was just like, I was just watching it like a hawk at the gym. No, I couldn't hear it. All I was seeing was the visuals. But watching things without audio actually lets you look at the filmmaking in a different light. And I was really impressed with just the subtle filmmaking of Ridley Scott and his DP, how they moved the camera and how they edited, how they framed, how they lit everything. And it was just like, I watched, I'm not kidding, 20 minutes of it. And I was like, I got to watch this movie soon. And so I put it on the other night. It's on Max if you want to watch it. And Thelma and Louise is not only just one of the coolest shot movies of the 90s, but it's just one of the coolest movies ever. Susan Sarandon and Gina Rowland, are fantastic in the title roles. Harvey Keitel plays a great detective on the case. And then you get supporting roles. Michael Madsen's fantastic in his few scenes. But it's a really excellent movie. It's, I think, the ultimate good for her movie. It's about liberation. It's about taking power back. It's about finding freedom within yourself and reaching your potential of who you can be. And just the transformations of both characters, it's phenomenal. It's a long movie. It's about 2 hours, 10 minutes. It's quite a hefty movie. You would think it's shorter, but it's not. It's a fantastic runtime. Every scene's important. Every scene's wonderful to behold. The lighting's unbelievable. It's just like, in Ridley Scott's range as a director, this was at a low point in his career, I would say. The late 80s, early 90s was his... He was on a streak of not very well-loved movies. And 1492, his movie before this, was a horrible failure. It was about Columbus. And so he was just on like a very streak... He was a streak of duds. And then this was huge for him. This movie made $300 million at the box office. Critical darling, everybody loved it, became iconic, and I think it rejuvenated his career and led it to him coming into a huge run in the late 90s, early 2000s, obviously. But Thelma and Louise was, I think, really big for him as a filmmaker, but also to show his range from, he did two landmark science fiction films, one of them being a science fiction horror, one of them just being a science fiction dystopian, and then he made a road trip Western action comedy. Like, what the, like, the, and they're all amazing. Like, the range of him as a filmmaker and then doing Gladiator only a few years after this is just, it's so impressive what he can do as a storyteller. And he can do any, he can build any kind of world. He can portray any kind of story. That's the testament of a true visionary filmmaker. I mean, just to go from Thelma and Louise after all those other films and then what he's done since then is just really impressive. And Thelma and Louise is just, it's such a fun movie. It's just also just one of the coolest movies ever. Brad Pitt's debut film. He's got 4 scenes in this movie, and he steals them all. He is, you can't take your eyes off of him. And you can see why he became such a big star. Because even in this movie where it's filled with 3 of Hollywood's biggest stars of the time, Keitel, Rowlands, and Sarandon, Brad Pitt is so memorable in all of his scenes.
Who, I think you're mixing names. I heard you say Gina Wilder.
And then, Gina Rowlands.
No, it's Gina Davis. Gina,
it is Gina Davis. Shit.
I was like,
who is Gina? That's what I'm mixing up.
I'm like, I was going to wait till you finish, but sorry. Like, who the hell is Gina Rowlands?
She's an older actress. I'm mixing up Gina Davis and Gina Rowlands. Gotcha. That's what I'm mixing up.
Gotcha.
So it's Gina Davis is this one.
I'm like,
sorry.
Who the fuck is Gina Rowlands and who is Gina Wilder? You said Gina Wilder too.
Did I say Wilder?
Yeah.
Gina Davis. Probably because of Gene Wilder. I said that.
Oh, 100% why.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a banger. It's got such a terrific ending too.
Yeah,
I love this film.
One of the best endings ever.
Brad is
ever.
So charming in this movie. He looks so hungry in it, though.
Yeah, he's skinny as hell.
He's like 120 pounds in this movie, soaking wet.
It's also got an early Hans Zimmer score that's just an absolute banger of harmonicas and in guitar and just like, oh my God, yes.
It's great. It's a great pick. All right. Well, that wraps our Letterboxd recap this week. Thank you, everyone, who sent in your Letterboxd for favorites. If you would like to hear us read yours out on the show, just send us a DM of a screenshot of your Letterboxd account and your homepage of your four favorites. We'll add it to the list and get to it eventually.
Eventually.
Thanks for tuning in this week. Again, stay tuned for movie news on Sunday. It's going to be a banger because CinemaCon is popping right now.
Popping!
And so Sunday is going to be an epic episode of movie news. Then next week, like I said, we are doing a John Doe episode, as well as we're going to do an episode next week on the 100 best movie stunts of all time. So lots of bangers coming for you this week. Stay tuned, everybody, for more. And take care.
See you next time.
Raiders of the Lost Podcast is a Mirror Image production. Sound mixing done by Jacob Kosler. Opening music by Chase Jackson.